This message is brought to you by Desiring God. For more information, please visit desiringgod.org.
Now, people have approached me holding up one of my children's books and flicking through it backwards, which is horrible for a writer. So it's sort of like this. I'll just demonstrate. Oh, yes, yes. So what is so horrible for a writer is it really means that it doesn't matter at all what order the words come in. It's neither here nor there. And that the words are really of no consequence. Anyway, this person came up to me cheerfully announcing, I'm going to do one. I mean, really, how hard can it be? Now, how many of us would ever dream of going up to a surgeon and saying, you know, I'm going to do an angioplasty. I mean, really, how hard can it be? That people feel free to say this about a children's book tells you a lot. Not so much about what they think about children's writers, because that's not important. But what they think about children. I think it's because they don't have a high enough view of children. Do they think that somehow for children anything will do? That the quality doesn't need to be as high as for adults? That you can get away with it with children? I believe that it's entirely the other way around. That nothing but excellence will do for children. That the quality for the young needs to be higher because the responsibility is greater. And that with children, as anyone should know, you get away with not one single thing. Do they think children won't notice? That they won't mind? Children know everything and are far smarter than we ever give them credit. A little four-year-old friend of mine, and you'll have to forgive me because I can't do Southern accent, but if you can imagine this as a Southern accent. So she's in the South and she's four, and she was in her playgroup, and she introduced herself to her teacher. This is where the Southern accent comes in. I knew you when I was a baby and proceeded to have a full-on conversation with the adult. At the end, she leaned in confidentially and said, I'm talking adult to you, but when my mama comes, I'm going to talk baby. That's a four-year-old. Children are not only smarter than we think, we have much to learn from them. Our proper attitude towards children should be humility. Poorly written books insult and demean children. We write up to children, never down. I mean, really, how hard can it be? I think it also tells you something else. I think it tells you that they have too low a view of story. What is the lesson in the story? What is the message? I'm often asked that. But a story is not a sermon. As writers, we know we better not preach on the page. Our job is to tell a story, not teach a lesson. Not tell you what to think about the story. If we have an agenda, a message in code that we want to get across, a moral we want to teach in our writing, it might be an excellent lecture, but it won't be a good story. It's way too low a view of what a story can do, of what a story can be. A story can do much more than teach you. It can transform you. So what is a story? A story works secretly, in silence, when it's given time, when it's given room, when we trust it, when it's not explained to death. I'm going to tell on myself. One time I was reading at a Sunday school, and I read from the Jesus Storybook Bible the story of Daniel and the scary sleepover to some six-year-olds. So now I'm going to read to you from Daniel and the scary sleepover. Things were not looking good for God's people. They had been captured and taken far from home, and now they were slaves of the king of Babylon. But God had not left his people. He was with them, and he was looking after them. Daniel loved God and obeyed him. Now, God made Daniel able to understand lots of difficult things, so it wasn't long before the king of Babylon noticed him. King Darius liked Daniel, particularly how very clever he was. So he made Daniel his most important helper of all and put him in charge of lots of other helpers. But the other helpers didn't like this. They wanted the king to like them best. They wanted to get rid of Daniel. So they spied on Daniel. They tried to find things wrong with him, things they could tell the king, things they could... But there weren't any. None. They couldn't find anything at all. Except they did notice one thing. Every day, three times a day, without fail, no matter what, Daniel went to his room, closed the door, and prayed. They smiled to themselves. Let's get the king to make a law. No one is allowed to pray to anyone except the king only. Daniel won't obey this law and he will be punished. They were pleased with themselves for being so clever and hurried off to tell the king. King Darius liked their idea. He didn't know they were tricking him. So he made it into a law. Everyone must pray only to me. If you don't, the lions will have you for their dinner. Daniel heard this. He knew it was wrong to pray to anyone except God. He had to do what God said, whatever it cost him, even if it meant he would die. So Daniel went to his room, closed the door, and prayed. That's just exactly what the bad men knew Daniel would do. They skipped straight off to the king. Oh, your most glittering highness, your law says, does it not, that everyone must pray alone to you, sire? Yes, said the king. Oh, magisterial brightness, then correct us if we're wrong, but Daniel is praying to God, not to you. The king was sad. He'd been tricked. He didn't want to hurt Daniel, but he couldn't change his law. So he let the soldiers throw Daniel to the lions. May your God, who you love so much, rescue you, the king said. The king went back to his palace, but he didn't sleep that night. Not a wink. He tossed and turned until finally, at the first glimmer of dawn, he leapt out of bed and ran straight to the den. Daniel, he cried, has your God rescued you? Yes, Daniel shouted. God sent an angel to close the lion's mouth. And there, resting his head on Daniel's lap, was the biggest lion of all, purring like a kitten. The king brought Daniel out of the den. Look, he said, Daniel doesn't even have a scratch. The king made a new law. Daniel's God is the true God, the God who rescues. Pray to him instead. God would keep on rescuing his people. And the time was coming when God would send another brave hero, like Daniel, who would love God and do what God said, whatever it cost him, even if it meant he would die. And together, they would pull off the greatest rescue the world has ever known. Now, one little girl in particular was sitting so close to me, she was almost in my lap. Her face was bright and eager as she listened to the story, utterly captivated. She could hardly keep on the ground. She was so excited and kept kneeling up. She wanted to get closer to the story. At the end of the story, there were no other teachers around, and I panicked and went into automatic pilot, because children's writers are not very good at controlling children. They do the opposite. And so I heard myself, to my horror, asking this. And so, children, what can we learn from Daniel about how God wants us to live? And as I said those words, it was as if I had literally laid a huge load on that little girl, like I broke some kind of spell. She crumpled in front of me, physically slumping and bowing her head. I will never forget it. It is a picture of what happens to a child when we turn a story into a sermon. Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me and don't ever stop them." Certainly, we don't want our stories to stop them. Because the power of the story isn't in the summing up or the drilling down or the reducing it into an abstract idea. The power of the story isn't in the lesson. The power of the story is the story. A story takes children seriously. Being childlike isn't being childish. We don't need to make funny faces or speak in ridiculous voices to engage children any more than we would with adults. Sometimes ridiculous voices are very good, but not all the time. Children certainly don't need us to do this to them for them to listen to us. What they need is for us to take them seriously. What they need is to be invited into the story, some of them for the first time. Oh, sorry. And this is no ordinary baby. This is the child upon whom everything would depend. This is the child who would one day, but wait, our story starts where all good stories start, right at the very beginning. A story invites imagination. A handful of images, someone said, are worth an armful of arguments. "Father," Jesus cried, "I give you my life." And with a great sigh, he let himself die. Strange clouds and shadows filled the sky, purple, orange, black, like a bruise. We must work harder to tell better stories and then trust the story and the child, and above all, God, to do the rest. We must trust their Heavenly Father and his ability to communicate with his children. We must trust the capacity of children to hear their Heavenly Father. Like that little 9-year-old in her dormitory one early morning in that old manor house in the middle of the New Forest, who heard something and wrote it down in her Oxford English Dictionary. A story doesn't dumb down. Maybe you can talk down to adults, but you cannot talk down to children. Are we dumbing it down? We dare not do that. Being simple isn't being simple-minded. Being simple is finding ways to say things in words young people can hear. It's distilling the story down to its simplest form. Miles Davis said, "Listen to what I can leave out." Blaise Pascal apologized for writing a long letter. "I made this so long only because I didn't have time to make it shorter." It takes hard work to be simple. It takes longer to be concise. Now, I wrote this book, How to Be a Baby by Me, the Big Sister, as a kind of revenge on my little sisters. You see, I'm a big sister, and if I was talking to children, I'd say, "How many people here are big sisters?" "Yes, there are lots, aren't there?" "And how many people here are little sisters?" "Yes, there are lots." "And how many people here are big brothers?" "Yes, and how many people here are little brothers?" See, there are lots of us around. But anyway, I'm a big sister. And what can I tell you? When I was about 2, long, long ago, back in the time of caves, when dinosaurs ruled the earth and parents left children in cars, my little sister, a fresh, plumpy newborn, and I were left in the back of our car while our parents popped out just for a second. When my parents left, I was sitting in the back seat and my baby sister was in a carry cot beside me. When they came back, my sister was on the floor and I was in the carry cot. So, of course, it was only a matter of time where I took further revenge on my 3 little sisters and wrote a shocking expose. It's called How to Be a Baby by Me, the Big Sister. When I was writing it, my challenge was how to write in the voice of a 6-year-old, self-appointed baby expert. I had to distill everything down into the words she'd use, into the pithy, funny definitions she'd give. How would she describe a pacifier, for instance? Here's what she told me. "A special plug goes in your mouth. It's called a pacifier, and it's to stop your scream coming out." Or what about a baby high chair? "When you're a baby, you don't sit in a chair. You are tied to it." Or how about a baby car seat? "And when you go in the car, you have to sit in a baby holder with a handle on it, and you don't even face the right way. I prefer to sit in a seat like a normal person." Or how about a baby carrier? "When you're a baby, you don't carry a backpack, you go in one." Or what about babies and books? "When you're a baby, you don't read books, you eat them." A story uses rich language. Watch what these 4 magical words do to a child. Once upon a time. Language isn't optional to the story. Language is the power of the story. Language weaves the spell. In the beginning was the word. An editor of mine on Tiny Bear's Bible, which is a Bible that looks like a bear, it's disguised as a bear, wanted me to change the language. She said because it was too hard. Instead of flung stars into space, she wanted me to put stars in space. Instead of painted the sky, she wanted me to write lit up the and instead of Yeah, sorry. Instead of painted the sky and lit up the sun, she wanted me to write made the sky, made the sun. Changing these words drained all the power and wonder out of the story, so I put them back. In the beginning, before time began, God was right there and he had a great plan. He flung stars into space, he painted the sky, he lit up the sun, he taught birds how to fly. But the crown of creation he saved for the end. He made Adam and Eve and became their best friend. If we dumb down the language to never risk having a word children don't understand, how will they learn? How will they learn except through story? A story tells the truth. Is our job to protect children from life or equip them for it? Children know only too well that there are monsters. If we don't tell them the truth, how can they trust us? They have deep fears and concerns. Are we taking children's fears seriously? Or are we just diverting them, entertaining them? We must tell children the truth. A friend in publishing told me of a woman who came up to her and said she didn't believe in reading fiction because she only reads things that are true. Are stories true? Jesus told stories, parables. In fact, one out of every three times Jesus taught, he told stories. They told the truth, but they didn't actually happen. Our stories must tell the truth, whether or not they're factual. Chesterton said, fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us dragons can be beaten. You need the darkness to show what light is. Even in board books for the very young, this is true. Another book I wrote called Hug a Bible. Again, it's got furry soft things on to make you want to hug it. One editor wanted me to write the resurrection story but not mention death. Because she didn't want to upset them, and death is a hard concept and we don't want to frighten children and they're only little. But the problem is, without death, there is no resurrection. So here's what I wrote instead. He died on a cross, but on the third day, he rose from the tomb, the stone rolled away. Jesus is living, he's risen, it's true. So that now, though we die, we'll live with him too. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting we go around scaring babies. But I am suggesting we work a little harder, because there is a way to be age-appropriate and tell the truth. No one is too young for the truth. When I was working on the story of the fall in the Jesus Storybook Bible, another editor asked me not to put the word serpent in there, because it might not be a word children understand, and it might be too scary for them. See for yourselves, what do you think it would have been without the word serpent? As soon as the snake saw his chance, he slithered silently up to Eve. Does God really love you? The serpent whispered. If he does, why won't he let you eat the nice, juicy, delicious fruit? Poor you, perhaps God doesn't want you to be happy. The snake's words hissed into her ears and sunk down deep into her heart like poison. Does God love me? Eve wondered. Suddenly, she didn't know anymore. Just trust me, the serpent whispered. You don't need God. One small taste, that's all, and you'll be happier than you could ever dream. Where is the story without the serpent? A story reaches the heart. Stories don't tell the truth confrontationally. They don't coerce you. They don't argue with you to believe them. They just are. Emily Dickinson said, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. A story doesn't come at you directly and raise a wall of defense. It comes around the side and it captures your heart. A story captures the heart. A story doesn't do the job of the reader for them. When we censor the story and we tie it up in a nice, neat little package and answer all the questions, we leave no room for mystery or discovery or wonder. We leave no room for the child, no room for God. Do you know the definition of a boring book? One that does the work of the readers for them. If children are not asking questions, that's when we should worry. Our focus needs to be not on giving all the right answers, but on raising the right questions. Because a story is a question, not an answer. And a story is a seed. Stories are the seeds we plant to grow in our readers' hearts. The seed is alive and growing and hidden. We work hard to till the soil. We provide a safe place for it to grow. We water, we shelter and protect it. But it's God who provides the growth. It's God who brings the harvest. What is the story God is writing in our children's hearts? What is the story God is writing in our children's lives? What clues is he planting? What clues is he planting? What story is he telling? Are we listening? And a story wakes you up. My niece, she was being bullied at school. She went from being a vivacious, imaginative child, full of life, to being a quiet little girl who spoke in such a quiet voice I couldn't even really hear her. And I was really worried about her. And when I found out she was being bullied, I found myself wishing there was a book that could tell her what God said about her instead of what the bullies said. And so I realized I needed to write a book. And it's called Thoughts to Make Your Heart Sing. I wanted her to have a book that she would choose to read before school. I wanted it to be a book of hope. Who are you? When you first meet someone, she might ask you, who are you? And you might say, well, I'm so-and-so, and I'm very good at this thing and that thing, and here's where I live, and this is my family. But do you know who God says you are? The one Jesus loves. The Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. And so it became a book of hope for children. Children look to us for everything, but in all that we've given children, have we forgotten to give them hope? Have we left them in despair, looking at what they should do but don't, looking at who they are and who they should be but aren't? How do we give hope to children? When we take the focus off them and put it back on God where it belongs. When we tell them truths like, God holds the oceans in the palm of his hand. If he can hold the oceans, he can hold you. If God cares for the tiniest sparrow, how much more must he care for you, his child? And I just love that arrow. It's so cool, isn't it? Because if you look at all the fancy birds, which was the one Jesus chose? The most boring one. I love that. If Jesus can calm a storm on a lake, he can calm the storm in your heart. This one's called Mighty Man of Valor. Where's this Mighty Man of Valor? Oh, it's him hiding in the wine press. In what way is he a Mighty Man of Valor, I wonder? But you see, God sees not just who you are, but who he's going to make you. And faith isn't just you holding on to God. It's God holding on to you. We give hope to children when we tell them what matters most. They don't need to be told to try harder, believe more, do it better. That just leaves them in despair, as it would us. The moral code always leaves us in despair. We can never live up to it. We don't need a moral code, we need a rescuer. What we need to know is that we are loved with a never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love. This is called free gift. Zacchaeus was a big sinner. He stole, cheated, lied. Why would Jesus love him? Did Zacchaeus say, I'll be a better person, and that's why Jesus wanted to be his friend? No, it was entirely the other way around. Even when no one else wanted anything to do with Zacchaeus, even before Zacchaeus mended his ways, Jesus was his friend. Jesus accepted him and loved him. Zacchaeus didn't have to do anything to make Jesus love him. And neither do you. Because you see, God's love is a free gift. You can't earn it. You don't deserve it. You can't pay for it. You need only open your hands to receive it. God saved you by his grace when you believed. And you can't take credit for this. It is a gift from God. Ephesians 2, verse 8. That is hope. Hope isn't glossing over things. It's telling the truth. Hope isn't wishful thinking. It's seeing life as it truly is. And hope isn't a vague wish. It's not wishing for something you think probably won't happen at all. Hope in the Bible is absolute certainty. And above all, hope isn't an escape. You've heard the classic children's prayer. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. But I heard about a little girl or a little boy who said it the wrong way and instead prayed, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should wake before I die. If I should wake before I die. She said it wrong. Or did she say it absolutely right? Have we woken up? Have our children woken up? Calvin said, there is not one blade of grass, there is no color in the world that is not intended to make us rejoice. How do we wake children up? We wake them up with the story. We wake them up with hope. My mother and her older brother were evacuated as small children from London during the Blitz. They went on the train with the labels tied around their necks, the whole deal. And the Blitz lasted 8 months, and it was a terrible time. Yet the majority of Londoners who survived would say it was the happiest time of their lives because they were part of something bigger, bigger than themselves, and they were living in hope. They were living for the future. They were living for what they were fighting for. They were living in hope. Children need to know that they are part of something bigger than themselves, part of a greater story. They need to know that God has a special plan for them, that it matters who they are, that it matters how they live, that he has a future for them, that God is making the story end happily for the world and for his children. Daisy devours books. Her brother, Tim, devours PlayStation games. When Daisy comes back from reading, she's bright-eyed and full of wonder. She's been somewhere. When Tim comes back from playing PlayStation, he's anxious and depressed. The game is a diversion, an escape. You forget your life when you play it. It puts your life on hold. The book, the story, takes you somewhere. It gives you something. Your life is richer for having read it, for having journeyed with it. Hope is a direction. Children don't need an escape. They need hope. Because hope isn't an escape. It's a destination. And the last thing to tell you is I think storytelling is a performance. How we read a book to children is really worth thinking about and practicing. You take your audience seriously by the amount of time you spend for preparing. A teacher friend of mine I heard about took the Yale Shakespeare and with a class of five-year-olds took that gigantic important book and read Midsummer Night's Dream. She broke it down into episodes and over several weeks read from it a little bit every day in episodes paraphrasing difficult words. The children kept everything straight, all the characters, and every week looked forward to it. They responded to how they were being treated. They could see how big this book was and felt that such a big book was important. It gave them a sense of how seriously they were being taken, how important they were, how much faith their teacher had in them. They loved it so much that they acted out a version of it. It came alive for them. This kind of response doesn't come from reading every line in blissful surprise in a funny voice. It doesn't come from avoiding hard words. It comes from a bigger intention. It comes from a great and deep respect for children. For the teacher of those five-year-olds, it was all about how much she gave them, not all at once, and the quality, excellent. But they were up for it. Are we? There may be things just above the children's heads. There may be things just beyond their reach. They may not know every word. They may not understand everything. But let the language weave its spell. Let the story ask its question. And then let children do what they love doing best, standing on tiptoes. A Chinese proverb says, a bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Feel free to copy and distribute this message to others, but please do not charge for the content or alter it in any way. For more resources, go to desiringgod.org.